Blog Talk Radio.
Listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, you know, sometimes people forget there are literally cameras everywhere. I was reading an article about the El Pasoans who were taken to Washington to be honored for their heroism demonstrated during the shooting at Walmart. And one gentleman who I thought was probably the person that tried the hardest was the man that allegedly threw soda bottles at the shooter. Turns out that didn't happen, at least according to the police and discussing the security camera footage. In fact, according to the article I read, he had an outstanding warrant. He got a certificate anyway. But that's what people forget. There are literally cameras everywhere. Now, that does not stop activity of a criminal sort, but it certainly is a witness you might not anticipate. There are people who sit and watch this camera footage, especially at the Stop and Shops. Well, we've been talking about strange happenings. Last night, when we closed, we were talking about a man that was paid back for a gift of kindness he showed an old lady. She'd been fired because she was too old to do her job, didn't have any money, so she had to walk to her son's home, which was a good distance. And it was raining and sleeting and snowing. He brought her into his house and put her in front of the fire and gave her something to eat, wrapped her up in a blanket. And then the next day, he took her to her son's home. Well, a while later, he had gone to a market in his horse and buggy. His wife was concerned it was going to storm, but you know how guys are. Well, there were two routes home. One was a somewhat winding way that took a while. And the other was more direct, but it was more dangerous. It also had a rickety wooden bridge. Well, when he finished at the market, he started home, and he stayed longer than he should have. And it was starting to storm. And he got to the fork in the road. One road would go to the bridge, and one road would go the winding way. And there stood the old lady that he had helped. Well, he, of course, picked her up, and she said, "I was waiting for you. I knew you were in town." And he started to go the short way. She said, "No, no, you can't. No, no, go the other way." Well, totally against his own wishes, he went the longer way. And dropped her off near her son's home. And went on home himself. And he went the longer way because the old lady seemed to get so upset. And then she fell asleep in the cart as he was on the way to her son's home. So he decided to stop by his own home and pick up a blanket to wrap her up. Maybe even take in there inside his own home and keep her warm for the night before finishing the trip. When he told his wife the old lady was asleep in his cart, she said, "You say you picked up the old woman and she came all the way back with you?" He said, "Yeah, she's right out there now." Well, she said, "That's odd because the old lady's daughter-in-law visited here today. You hadn't been gone long when she came and said the old bridge on the short route was down." And she paused for a moment and said, and she said something else. "Her mother-in-law, the old lady that you helped twice, died 2 weeks ago." Well, the man turned and ran out to his cart, and it was empty. The sleeping old lady had disappeared. Of course, he totally puzzled, but he put his horse up and got it ready for the night. Now, some things we just don't explain. Some things we shouldn't try to explain. Let's go to Beaver Lodge in Hammersmith. The year is 1883. The Richmond family had moved in to make that Hammersmith there, the Beaver Lodge, their London home. They'd only been there a few days when they started to hear strange noises. Miss Richmond, who was sitting one evening in the living room, was startled to hear somebody sobbing. She was alone in the house and wondered what was going on and who'd gotten in without her seeing, so she went to find out. And although the weeping and sighing went on for over 30 minutes, and she searched every room and cupboard in the house, she didn't find anybody. A few days later, the crying and sobbing was heard again. This time it was broad daylight, and right before the family sat down to lunch, everybody fanned out and searched the house from top to bottom, didn't find a soul. Well, from time to time, the wailing varied in its intensity and volume. Sometimes it sounded so faint it might have been the wind sighing softly through the trees. At other times it was so loud it almost drove the family to leave the house. Then one wet afternoon, England is known for, shall we say, inclement weather. Miss Richmond was having tea in the drawing room with some of her friends. And she looked up and she saw the ghost. And at least two of her companions saw her as well. The apparition was so real, in fact, that Miss Richmond thought a stranger had walked into the room. Because there was a tall, elegantly dressed woman standing behind them. some strange reason, the figure was holding a shawl across the lower half of her face. And she was crying, as usual. And abruptly, she gave a loud sob and vanished. After that, Ms. Richmond and some other members of the household encountered that woman's ghost on several occasions and at different times of the day and night. And she was always concealing the lower half of her face with her shawl. Well, many serious attempts were made to find some explanation for the haunting. The past history of the house was studied in detail. People who lived for many years in the district were questioned, but they couldn't find any answer. Nobody knew anything at all about the ghost or why she should be haunting that particular house. Well, there was a theory that the sounds might have been made by water underground passing under Beaver Lodge. I mean, one reason for this theory was that the house sat on near some mills that were worked partly by floodwater. But when seriously considered, it was unlikely any underground water would sound like somebody heaving deep sighs or crying. And besides, the sounds are only heard intermittently and for varying lengths of time. If it was underground water, to be heard all the time. And finally, the one thing that theory could never have explained away was that the sounds were heard only when the ghost was present. And although the mystery was never solved, one strange thing did happen a number of years later. In 1920, when the house was being demolished, workmen found a skeleton buried in the cellar. Medical experts declared it was a woman's remains. That's the extent of what they could determine. But there was one interesting fact. The lower part of the skull had been brutally smashed in. The same area that the ghost covered with her shawl. Well, you know, sometimes events happen that have no rational explanation. Try as we might, we can't come up with any reason. And that's the situation that seems to have happened to Edgar Vandy. The event happened one hot summer day in August of 1933. 38-year-old Edgar Vandy, a brilliant engineer, and Ken Donnan, a friend, drove from London to spend a weekend with another friend who lived on a country estate in Sussex. When they arrived, though, they found their friend wasn't home. Now, Ken and Edgar decided to be refreshing to take a dip in a swimming pool that was some distance from the house. Edgar wasn't a very good swimmer. It was a very hot day, and the pool looked so calm and so invitingly cool. The swimming pool was about 4 feet deep at one end and about 8 feet deep at the other. The two young men went behind some shrubs nearby to change into their swimming trunks and raced to see who reached the pool first. Edgar won, and Ken later said how he saw him splashing about in the water. It took a moment or two for Ken to realize that Edgar was in trouble. He dove into the pool to rescue him. Although he succeeded in reaching Edgar, he couldn't get a firm grasp. And Edgar sank under the water and was dead by the time Ken got him out. The doctor who was summoned by the police suggested Edgar might have been knocked unconscious when he dove into the pool because there were two slight bruises on his chin, one on his shoulder and another on his chest. At the inquest that followed, though, Edgar's brother, Harold Vandy, said that Edgar would never have dived into swimming pools. He was a poor swimmer and had never attempted diving before. Well, after the coroner's inquest was over, the verdict was death by misadventure. But the end of the inquest is only the beginning of a mystery about Edgar Vandy's death that has never been completely solved to this day. Another Vandy brother, George, was a member of the Society for Psychic Research. They weren't satisfied with the explanation for Edgar's death. Both his brothers decided to try to contact him through a medium. He was a small man, so a medium would probably have been sufficient. Three different mediums held seances, and present each time were note takers on each occasion, different individuals. And one seance was attended by Ken Donnan, who had been with Edgar when he drowned. It was felt that Ken might help make contact with Edgar's spirit. The three mediums, Miss Frances Campbell of Hyde Park Mansions, Miss Doris Mason, and Miss Naomi Bacon of the British College of Psychic Sciences. All three mediums gave accurate information about the manner of Edgar's passing, and certain personal details later proved to be accurate, as told by Edgar's spirit. But try as they might, no real light was thrown on the exact cause of his death. Now, the medium said his spirit seemed not to want the inquiry to be made, and it appeared he really had slipped and struck his head. His spirit also spoke of somebody being near him and who might have helped, but that person was too frightened. But according to the mediums, his spirit felt no resentment. He was merely sad because his death didn't have to have happened. Now, none of the mediums was given any prior information about the case. Each was given a false name and address by the Vandy brothers. But it is significant that information of a technical nature was given to him by Edgar Spirin about his work, which they couldn't have known about before, as well as some information later proved correct that wasn't known to any person living. In spite of some irrelevancies, there's no doubt the mediums gave a clear picture of Edgar's personality, qualities of mind, character, and his technical ability. The sittings convinced both the brothers that Edgar had survived his death and that the real truth about his departure from this life remained a secret. So what was it Edgar didn't want to reveal? Well, that secret went to the grave. Well, sometimes certain aspects of personalities survive the grave. This particular story deals with an individual who had the habit of whistling a particular tune. He was called the Whistling Ghost. John Lafferty came from Ireland in 1896 to work as a laborer on a farm near Long Parish in Hampshire, which was owned by Joshua Mander. Now, Mander had the reputation of being the meanest man in the south of England. He wanted his workers to slave away for long hours, fed them very... and only paid him when and if he felt like doing so. When the young Irishman came to the farm seeking work, the farmer saw an opportunity to get something for nothing. And he put Sean to work at once. Having no place of his own to live, it was agreed that Sean would live at the farm with an adjustment to be made to his wages for his food and lodging. The farmer saw how the arrangement could give him great scope for obtaining another laborer very cheaply. His first meal there wasn't very inspiring. It was supper, and all he got was a slice of dry bread and a small dish of badly cooked oatmeal porridge. And as soon as he finished, Mander ordered him off to his bed because he'd have to be up to working the next morning before dawn. Well, Sean didn't much care for this beginning, but he was in need of a job, so he didn't say anything. Well, long before he began to regret having taken a job, because the farmer worked him hard, kept him at it every single minute of the day, to the point the poor young man began to feel permanently exhausted. The only day Sean got any time off on was Sunday, and the only reason for that was the farmer didn't dare work him all day on Sunday because of what his neighbors might say about it. All the same, it did grieve the farmer to think of Sean having time in which to be idle. And the meals at the farm didn't improve, and the staple diet seemed to be dry bread and porridge. Sean made friends with another Irishman, a man who worked on another farm, and He got little chance to see much of his new friend, for if the man even dared to show his face at the farm where Sean worked, Mander chased him off to go about his business, shouting that all Irishmen were nothing but lazy layabouts. Well, Sean grew homesick, but his one comfort was to be able to whistle his favorite Irish tune while he worked. And the farmer even tried to stop him whistling, but at this, Sean showed some spirit. He responded, "'Tis little enough pressure I have and little enough I could bring with me from dear old Ireland. But I brought me whistling me Irish tune. Now nobody's going to take either one from me." Mander wasn't a happy camper because that whistling sure irritated him, but he didn't press the matter because he didn't want to lose such a good hard worker. And one he got, frankly, very cheaply. So Sean worked hard and didn't get any pay. His wages would be paid at the end of the 6 months agreed period. But according to the law, if he left before then, his employer would be entitled to keep his wages. Well, by the end of 3 months, Sean had more than he could stand, and he told Mander he's going to leave. And Mander said, "Well, suit yourself, but if you do, you don't get paid a penny. You only get paid if you stay the full agreed period from planting time to harvest." Well, Sean argued he'd worked hard for 3 months. He said he'd be content with 1 month's pay, and the farmer gave him, and that gave the farmer 2 months of his labor for nothing. But Mander stuck to his position. He wasn't going to give him a penny if he didn't stay 6 months. Well, Sean's temper fired up. He said, "If you force me to stay on and work the way I've had to work for you these last 3 months, it'll kill me. Already it's whittled down me weight and made me sick, man. And I'm warning, if you kill me with work, then I'll die. I'll come back here and haunt you." And this made the farmer just roar with laughter. He said, "Go get on with your work. I wasted enough time listening to your nonsense." Within a month, Sean was gravely ill and died at the farm. Farmer's only concern was he had to pay the funeral expenses, even though he didn't have to pay 4 months' wages to the dead man. Well, it was exactly 1 week later that Mander got the first indication he was being haunted. Working in the field some distance from the house, he heard the whistling. Now, he had heard it before so many times he couldn't fail to recognize it as the Irish boy's favorite tune. Well, the farmer stopped and looked around and began to shake because he saw the phantom figure of the dead Irishman coming toward him across the field. And as he got close, it said in a kind of a echoey voice, as if coming from a great distance, "You owe me, farmer, and I'll never leave you till what's owed is paid." Well, Mander, shaken with fear, was about to ask how he could put things right when the ghost vanished into thin air. Well, the farmer ran for dear life all the way back to the farm. And that very night, he sought out the friend that Sean had made on his neighboring farm. And he gave that laborer full 4 months' wages that would have been due to Sean and begged the Irishman, "See this money gets to Sean Lafferty's family or I'll never know any peace of mind again." A few days after he'd sent the money to Sean's family in Ireland, Mander heard that whistling one more time. And he looked out the window and he saw the ghost walking away from him across the fields. He'd got what he wanted. He was satisfied. Well, you know, sometimes children who don't have the impossibility factor can see things the adults can't. Such was the case with the children of Jane Edwards. She heard her children screaming in fright, and she went tearing up the stairs late one night in February 1932. Rushing into their bedroom, she found them cowering under the bedclothes, and she comforted them until she got them calmed down where they were could make sense. And she said, "What happened?" Her oldest daughter finally said they'd just seen their grandfather. He'd walked up the stairs, looked around the bedroom door at him, and then vanished into the other bedroom. The odd thing about that was the bedroom in which he had died some months before. I wonder what had really frightened him. Ms. Edwards looked into that other room, and it was completely empty. Nobody had been living in there since the grandfather died because the roof needed to be repaired. Now, she didn't disbelieve her daughters, as strange things had happened in that Wiltshire cottage during the past few months. And her daughters weren't the only members of the household to have seen something else moving about the house. She didn't want to admit it, but she'd also seen the old man. Apart from the five daughters who are also living there, Ms. Edwards' mother and her oldest son, James Bull, and Frank Edwards, Jane's husband. And they're all beginning to believe the ghost of Samuel Bull, Ms. Edwards' late father, had returned from his grave because this phantom had been seen by all five children. When they told Ms. Edwards' brother, James Bull, he told him he had also seen his father's ghost. One night, the ghost went into the room where his widow lay ill and placed a cold hand on her brow. When she learned the rest of the family had all seen her husband's ghost, the old lady finally admitted it was not the first time she'd seen her dead husband. After that, the ghost of the old man reappeared not only at night but during the daylight hours and was seen by all the family. Now, the ghost didn't glide, as sometimes we're told that they do. He walked, and it spoke once, calling the sick old woman by her Christian name. On occasions, the ghost was seen as clearly seen for as long as a half hour at a time. Well, Ms. Edwards was unable to describe the color of the clothes worn by the ghost, but she did state quite definitely he wore a scarf of a different color than the rest of his clothes. And in one ghastly aspect, she reported that the knuckles of the ghost's hand seemed to protrude through the skin. And another weird feature was the family was always aware of the presence long before any of them actually saw it. And they always sensed the peculiar restlessness before the phantom appeared. Now, Ms. Edwards described this strange feeling as similar to expecting a special family visitor whom one hadn't seen for many years. And the presence of the ghostly figure was certainly eerie by anybody's standards. I mean, all the more so because the only light in the cottage at night was from candles, which, of course, flickered. Sometimes a ghost appeared during the daytime when Frank Edwards is at work and the children were at school, but in every instance, the apparition was seen with remarkable clarity. All who saw the ghost noticed this extremely sad expression, and this was ascribed to the poor and squalid conditions in which they were living. And this seemed to be borne out later when the family had a chance to move to a new house because the ghost moved as well and appeared to become much happier. In fact, the change in the ghost was so remarkable, Ms. Edwards declared she could detect a strange luminosity about the specter. Well, soon the children grew accustomed to their grandfather's ghost, and inevitably news of the spirit spread. A local man, Admiral Hyde Parker, learned about it and told the Earl of Selborne, who reported it to the Society for Psychical Research. And one of their investigators, the Earl of Balfour, asked the local vicar, the Reverend George Hackett, to compile a report on the haunting. After the family moved into their new house, the owner of the old cottage planned to renovate it. So the vicar advised the Society for Psychical Research if they wanted to investigate, they had to get with the program. Well, the alleged theory that the Edwardses had concocted the story to draw attention to their bad living conditions was soon dismissed because they all repeated their stories without any variations. So the investigators were convinced the family was telling the truth. But no investigation turned up any reason for ghostly visits in the old house. Eventually, the ghost of Sam Bull was concerned only with staying with his family and followed them wherever they went. Now, as for the ghost moving, there was a case I was told about. It happened here at Fort Bliss. One of the majors, his wife was open-minded about things, was promoted and was given new, larger quarters on what's called Colonel's Row. That's the area along the post where, you know, they're big houses, and that's where the field grade officers live. And the now, they believed the quarters they were living in when he got the promotion were haunted. And everybody knew the story, and they had a party, and everybody kept asking them, were they going to take the ghost with them? And it annoyed the wife to the point she got a big box, sat it in the floor in the living room, and they had named the ghost George for some reason. And she said, George, if you want to go with us, be in the box. The movers are coming in the morning. Well, when the movers showed up, that box was taped shut. And it took three of them to put it on the truck. When everything was moved to the new quarters and the family got home that evening, the box was sitting in the floor and had written George on the side, so there was no doubt about which box was set aside for George. And it was untaped and open. And everyone confirmed that, yes, George had come with them because the hauntings continued at the new quarters. Now, I wrote a book called The History and Mystery of Fort Bliss, Texas. Well, I reported a lot of the stories that I've been told by the various people. There is a style of house that you don't see anymore. But they were big with wraparound porches. And one of them here at Fort Bliss is called the Pershing House. I think at one point General Pershing, who had been, though he didn't have any duties that I could discover, he did live at Fort Bliss for a time. And supposedly he was here to learn the lay of the land because there is a story that Pancho Villa's attack was actually planned in order to give us reason to test new equipment in battlefield conditions by going into Mexico. In fact, when I was writing the book, I was introduced to an elderly gentleman. I think he was up in his 80s. And he said he had lied about his age. He's always been big. And he enlisted at 14. And he wound up being General Pershing's Batman, or personal servant. Because in those days, generals had servants. And he said, in the evening, during the day, the troops were chasing Pancho Villa. And in the evening, Villa and his senior people would come down from the hills, and General Pershing and his staff and Villa and his people play cards all night. And then the next morning, they'd rejoin their respective units, and the chase would begin again. And there was a display of pictures at the Pershing House that showed Pancho Villa and General Pershing together. Several of them were taken at the Pershing House. And when Pershing's family was killed, they were at the Presidio in San Francisco. And a fire there resulted in the death of his family. One of the first mourners to show up was Pancho Villa. So there's still a lot of that story that's not known. But the Pershing House has long had a history of being haunted. One of the generals, he was the second in command of the post, lived there. He was also commanded of one of the major units. And he was, he and his wife were called to Washington. And they had a dog, and they couldn't take the dog with them. So they asked the commander's aide, who was very aggressive female captain, if she would stay in the house. The kids were gone. They had two or three kids. And take care of the dog. And, of course, she agreed. And she was telling me the story, and she said, the strangest thing started happening. When she left for work every morning, she would lock the house tight. When she'd get home, the windows would be open, but nothing would be gone. And she said she was so busy during the first week she was there, she didn't have a chance to do her laundry. She put it in a basket in the corner. And one Friday, when she got home and walked in, to the room she was staying in, there was the laundry sitting in the middle of the floor. Well, she got the laundry, she got the dog, and went back to her own quarters. Before that happened, she said one morning in the early, early hours, she heard the pots and pans in the kitchen. And she could smell bacon frying, and she could smell coffee. Now, her thought was it was coming from one of the quarters around there. You know, on a military post, life starts early in the morning. So she said to herself, as she's explaining all this to me, does she pull the cover over her head, go back to sleep and hope it goes away, or go down to the kitchen and find out what's going on? Well, being who she was, she got up, went down to the kitchen. As she started through the door to the kitchen, the dog gets in front of her and will not let her step into the kitchen. It does everything it can to keep her from going through that door. As she said, she could feel the cold coming through that door. And after a few minutes, it faded away. On another occasion, the general and his wife were gone over the weekend, and when they got back, one of the neighbors said, "Who was the old lady sitting up on the second floor?" They said, "Who are you talking about?" "There's an old lady sitting in the rocker up on the second floor." Well, they had no idea who it was. And one of the daughters told me that every night before she fell asleep, or as she's falling asleep, she would feel someone pull the blanket up around her neck and her hair being smoothed back off her forehead. Pershing House is certainly quite haunted. If you're interested in the ghost of that military post, you can find the book on my website, kenhudnall.com, or at Amazon. And we're going to start releasing a lot of the older books on Kindle, so be watching for that. You know, there is a story about a man named Victor Grayson. And if he's still alive, there's an expensive overcoat waiting to be collected by him from a hotel in the West End of London. It's been there ever since the day he vanished, September 1920. And there's a fortune estimated to be several thousand British pounds waiting for him. You see, he was drawing a disability pension from the New Zealand government. The money's been just building up in the account and drawing interest. And like most government pensions, unless there's proof of death, the payment continues. Now, if Victor Grayson was still alive today, he'd be about 140. So my guess is he's probably not alive. But he would be the only person to unravel a mystery that baffled the world for quite some time. Now, he was a brilliant, wealthy politician who had everything in the world to live for, everything in the world to stay around to enjoy, because he was at the peak of his career in 1920. But for no reason anybody's ever been able to find out, he did something completely unexplainable. He was having a quiet drink with some business friends in a hotel in the Strand in London. He'd been having a pleasant social get-together and been discussing Grayson's future plans. Suddenly he noticed everybody's glass was empty, pulled out a wallet stuffed with banknotes, and called a waiter over. Took out a 5-pound note, ordered drinks all around, put the banknote on the table, and excused himself. Said, I'll be back in 5 minutes. Don't anybody steal my drink. And he walked off. The hotel doorman knew Grayson very well and opened the door for him. Grayson was cheerful as he walked by and walked out into the Strand. For a second, he hesitated, looked around him, and walked quickly off down the street. And that's the last time anybody's known to have seen him. Nobody's ever discovered why he chose to vanish so completely and suddenly. And nobody's found out what made him leave, and nobody knows where he went. But his disappearance caused a huge political mystery, and even at this late date, there's still an active file at Scotland Yard. Because this was not an ordinary man. This man raised himself from a backstreet slum in Liverpool to become one of the most prominent political figures of his day. Now, his first job was a board laborer in a factory, but there was a restlessness about it made him go to sea to see something in the world and educate himself. By the time he got back home, he had taught himself to read and write and picked up a smattering of several European languages and just enough knowledge to give him a thirst for more. After 3 more years in a factory studying at nights in his room, he won a scholarship to the university. Well, this was all part of his plan. He worked hard at Manchester University, where he aimed for and succeeded in getting an honors degree. And all his spare time as an undergraduate was spent in public speaking lessons, losing his working class accent. And then at 25 years of age, newly graduated, he hit the headlines for the first time as socialist candidate in the 1907 election, unseated a liberal incumbent from a safe liberal seat. Without any real Labour Party support, he became the first socialist member of Parliament. And his success made him a popular hero with the working intellectual class, and an adulation which Grayson adored because he was the complete exhibitionist, handsome, well-dressed, well-spoken, and frankly, brilliant. In a remarkable short time, he became the idol of English society, married the beautiful daughter of a wealthy merchant banker, and many politicians predicted that someday he'd become the British Prime Minister. Well, in 1913, he lost his seat in Parliament, but that didn't faze him. Told everybody he'd return to politics, but first he wanted to spend some time with his wife and family. Sailed for New Zealand with his wife and daughter about the time the First World War broke out. Joined the New Zealand Army, where he rose rapidly through the ranks to become an officer. His bravery and qualities as a leader saw him mentioned on dispatches on many occasions. But in one campaign, he was badly wounded, discharged, and awarded a disability pension. This was the beginning of a run of bad luck for him, because shortly after he got back to London with his wife and daughter, his wife died. For several years, he lived quietly near Liverpool with his daughter. And then suddenly he sent her to live with his wife's parents and announced he's going to return to politics. Threw himself into his work and appeared to overcome the sadness everyone had noticed about him. The beginning of September 1920, left his home in Liverpool to address a political meeting in Hull. This was to have been his second debut. His friends all remarked on how exuberant he seemed, full of confidence he was for the long battle back to Parliament. After leaving Liverpool for Hull, the first strange thing happened. He went to London instead of Hull. For a few days, he attended parties, luncheons, and race meetings with old friends and never once made any reference to the meeting at Hull. Everybody who met him in London remarked on the return of the old Grayson, the gay, confident extrovert who was the life and soul of the party. And then inexplicably, he vanished, leaving his overcoat, several pounds changed from his round of drinks, and a group of baffled friends and business colleagues. For the next 10 years, nothing was heard about him. He had vanished more completely than anybody could have believed possible. Yet in the '30s, reports began to filter back to his friends and relatives he'd been seen. Somebody recognized him at a race course near Cape Town. He was seen working on a sheep ranch in Australia, living in a lodge house in a Skid Row area of London. Although investigators jumped on these rumors. Nothing came of them. And two of the men who had last been in his company reported to Scotland Yard they'd seen him on two occasions. First time, both men had been standing in Charing Cross, chatting. Feeling somebody was watching them, they looked around and saw a smartly dressed Victor Grayson across the street. They said he grinned at them. When they tried to cross the road, he hailed a taxi and drove away. Taxi cab driver was later questioned, and after identifying Grayson's photograph, said he dropped his passenger in St. James Park. Second time he was seen by one of those close friends was in 1940, during the war. This man saw Grayson and a woman in the subway. This time Grayson looked older, more tired and strained, and he was wearing an officer's uniform. As the other men pushed through the crowd towards Grayson, they heard the woman address him as Vic. And they both moved through the crowds, arms linked, and went out of the station. Grayson's friend ran after him, but once again, Victor Grayson vanished into the crowded Strand. And hadn't been seen since. Now, this is not as far-fetched as it seems. Even today, in this, the most document-crazy country in the world, 200,000 to 300,000 people a year just vanish. Walk out the door and never seen again. Go into the dressing room in a department store, never come out. Now, 7 or 8 out of 10, poor man's divorce, running from bill collectors. But 2 or 3 out of 10 have absolutely no reason to vanish, no way to vanish if they could, nowhere to go if they did vanish. Been a lot of stories about unexplained disappearances. I did a study in college. And this was many moons ago. I was learning programming. And they said, pick a topic. My initial degree was in criminal justice, so I was studying missing persons. And I programmed in all the missing persons cases I could find. And I discovered that most people vanish on Wednesday or on the 24th of the month. And when Wednesday falls on the 24th, it's like somebody goes ape. Sometimes some of those people who vanish have similar jobs, or they look similar, or drive similar cars. And rarely do any of those that mysteriously disappear turn up again. There was one family, entire family at Fort Benning, went to visit family for Christmas, were never seen again. Their car was found sitting in a lake, in a riverbed off the interstate. No clue as to how the car got down to the riverbed. There are many, many mysteries that we don't have any idea about. You know, one of the occupations that takes you into contact with the unknown many times is that of traveling salesman. Keith Paintner was a traveling salesman. His job took him all over England, often driving for long distances to see his customers. So his occupation led him to have the strange experience he did in October 1928. He had a profitable day in Huddersfield and set out to drive to a small town in Wales where he had several appointments for the next day. Now, it was a long journey. He didn't reach his destination until well after midnight, and he'd forgotten to call ahead to make hotel reservations. As he drove into the small Welsh town, the streets were deserted, the shops were shut, and there was nobody who could direct him to a hotel or a guest house. So he drove around the streets wondering what to do, and then he saw a shop window just ablaze with lights. Stopped his car, walked up, and peered through the window. It was a butcher shop. The window was piled high with joints of meat and pies and sausage and all the merchandise you would expect to see in a butcher shop. Then he saw the man standing in the shop. And it was the shopkeeper himself, he decided, by looking at the man's clothes. But he couldn't see the man's face as he was standing with his back to the window, bending forward to peer into a refrigerated cabinet. Now, frankly, he was surprised to see the butcher in his shop at such a late hour. And it was unusual to leave meat in the window all night as well. But there was a lot of it. Now, he was glad the man was there because he hoped he'd be able to direct him to some place where he could spend the night. So he tapped on the window to attract the man's attention, but he didn't look around. So he tapped even harder. Finally, the man slowly turned to stare out through the window, and Keith Painter was just aghast at what he saw. The man's throat had been slashed with the chopper he was holding in his hand, and blood was spouting out all over his white jacket. The painter rushed around to try to open a door, but it was locked, so he ran along the road to a telephone booth and called the local police station. By the time the patrol car had arrived, the lights in the shop were out. There was no movement to be seen. Police listened to his story and directed him to a hotel. He was surprised by their nonchalance, but was too upset and tired to do anything other than follow their directions and go to the hotel, pay for a room, and go to bed. Next morning, he asked the hotel manager, the police, to come by looking for him, and the manager was puzzled and asked what was wrong, so Painter told him what he'd seen at the butcher shop. Well, he noticed the landlord looked shocked. He said, "What's the matter? Did I say something wrong?" And he said, "Did you say you saw the butcher shop?" And Painter nodded, and he said, "Well, you couldn't have. See, that shop's been empty for more than a year." And Painter, it was his turn to be shocked. He said, "But I did see him." He broke off and stared at the landlord, realizing he must have seen a ghost. And he realized why the police had seemed so calm about it. The landlord went on to explain the man who ran that shop was almost bankrupt, and about a year ago he found lying across the coal cabinet with his throat cut. It was decided it was probably suicide. Well, I've said several times that time is not always a linear progression. It appears that sometimes it circles. And sometimes we can cross into other times. Consider, if you will, the case of Jim Bradley and his wife. They were taking their first trip to France after the war, but the summer of 1954 was wet and cold and windy. Today they picked to visit the Palace of Versailles. It started off as one long, nonstop thunderstorm, but having traveled all the way from Yorkshire, the Bradleys were determined to see the splendor of that palace and the grounds, no matter what the weather was like. Strolling through the wet grounds around Versailles, they reached the Trianon, spot where there was a path leading to the village of Hamieux, said to have been a favorite walk of Marie Antoinette's. And because of the foul weather, the Bradleys hadn't seen anybody else during their excursions. Were just on the point of going back to the car when the weather changed. Suddenly, the sun appeared through the clouds and the rain stopped. Instead of cheering them up, though, the Bradleys only felt a strange drop in the temperature. Everything around them seemed so still and so cold, and they didn't even hear any birds singing. Leaving the Grand Trianon buildings behind them, they walked across the parklands, and they seemed to have started a journey which to lead them into the past. As the mist that had been shrouding everything lifted, they realized they had not been alone on the grounds, as they had imagined. Because coming along the path toward them were three other people, two men and a woman. Well, until the group got closer to Jim Bradley, heard his wife gasp with surprise, and leaning close, she pointed out the unusual clothes the other woman was wearing. The dress was a vivid, striking orange color with a close-fitting bodice, a full skirt reaching down to her ankles, and with attractive frilled-out material at the waist.
The Bradleys were quite close to the other group. Miss Bradley was so intrigued by the other woman's gown, she didn't bother to notice what the other two men were wearing. She did notice we were wearing dark garments, but Bradley himself noticed the men's costumes were, to say the least, unusual. From more than 40 yards away, he observed that the men wore long coats reaching to their knees, black breeches, stockings, and shoes with silver buckles. And the trio were chatting gaily among themselves as they walked along. Well, not wishing to seem inquisitive or nosy, the Bradleys tried not to stare too obviously at the other three people as they drew closer and tried to pay attention to their attractive surroundings. And then, to their amazement, the three people coming toward them just literally vanished. They couldn't have passed out of sight behind any trees because there were none near their route. Nor could they have left the path, which had a high wall and a ditch running alongside it. Miss Bradley was just shaken. She said, "Where did it go?" Bradley shook his head, agreeing that the sudden disappearance of the three was strange. But something even stranger happened. Suddenly and dramatically, the Bradleys felt a strange sensation as walking through a silent tunnel. One moment they'd been in sunlight, where the only sound had been their footsteps and voices, next to a back in the noise of a rainstorm. Well, neither of the Bradleys ever had any interest in the supernatural before this experience. Neither of them had experienced anything similar since then. Well, several strange things followed their experience. Later that morning, when questioned an attendant at Versailles, they asked him about the oddly dressed trio they'd seen during the break in the thunderstorm. Now, the attendant's reply confused him. He said there'd been no break in the storm as the rain and thunder had lasted all morning, and nobody else but the Bradleys had been seen wondering about Versailles that day. But there had been stories about supernatural appearances near that spot, which had been a favorite part of the garden for Marie Antoinette. When the attendant told him that, he led him to a portrait of the ill-fated queen herself. The background in the portrait was the same as where the Bradleys had seen the woman, and the woman they had seen was the subject of the portrait. They had seen Marie Antoinette. Sometimes truth is much, much stranger than fiction. I grew up in a house. The original apartment was built in 1815. I was always seeing and hearing strange things. My grandmother assured me I was just crazy. I'd grow out of it. Instead, when I retired, I turned it into a business. There are many, many things we don't see. There are many, many things beyond our ability to see. But for now, we have run out of time once again. Monday night, we'll be back with more stories of the bizarre. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening. Thank you.